and welcome to the Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Phil England, and my guest today is Melanie Strickland, a practicing lawyer and part of a legal campaigning group called Wild Law UK. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about the upcoming Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit in June, and whether a nature should have rights under the law, how communities can fight back against corporations, and how some of this might relate to the global Occupy movement. So welcome to the show, Mel.
Thank you. Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about Wild Law UK and what the aims of the group are.
Okay. Well, Wild Law has been around for quite a few years, but we're becoming more and more of a formal group. Our aim is to implement rights of nature in legislation. We're very heavily influenced by the book that was written by a South African lawyer called Cormac Cullinan. His book was called Wild Law, A Manifesto for Earth Justice. And it basically outlines how we can... the justice of getting laws that promote the health and integrity of the earth as a whole. And he in turn was influenced by many other people. And the Wild Law Group exists to sort of promote that philosophy and try and get these laws actually implemented in the UK and globally.
Okay. So the idea of rights for nature, how long has that idea been around, and where did that? What's the genesis of those ideas? Is there a kind of history to them?
There is. Yes, I mean, Wild Law is actually about recognising the rights of nature rather than giving rights to nature. It's quite an important distinction. It's like with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That document doesn't confer rights on human beings. It says that human rights people have rights by virtue of being human. So it's about recognising the dignity and inherent worth of the human person. The same would apply to nature. So we're saying we want the legal system to recognise the inherent rights of nature, the inherent worth of nature. And where this idea comes from, I think the person, as I understand it, that has done most to explore these ideas was a philosopher or an eco-theologian, an academic and monk called Thomas Berry, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But he wrote various works. One of the books he wrote was called The Great Work, and in that he outlines how human beings need to move into the ecozoic age, and the task of human beings is to transform our institutions. In particular, he focused on law, our legal structures, so that they encourage us to live in a way that is mutually beneficial, you know, with nature, with the planet. And other people were very influenced by Thomas Berry, in particular Cormac Cullinan, who wrote Wild Law, a Manifesto for Earth Justice, after reading some of Thomas Berry's works. I know there are lots of other people in the States where Thomas Berry was from who were very much influenced by his ideas. And there's an organisation in the US called the Community Environmental Legal Defence Fund, who have been sort of working in this area as well for quite some time.
Okay, so we now have, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights probably goes back around 50 years or something.
Yeah, I think that that came into effect in 1945 or 48. It's very shortly after the Second World War.
Okay, so that gives certain rights to human beings in theory, and to a certain extent that has been translated into eventually European law, for example, and then as a result of that into UK domestic law.
Yes.
But that in itself was quite a long process, I believe.
Yeah.
And how effective has that been?
In terms of human rights, in terms of implementing human rights?
Yeah.
Well, it was actually quite soon after the Universal Declaration on Human Rights that Europe adopted human rights. We had the European Convention on Human Rights. I think it was 1948. It was only a couple of years after the UN adopted it. It took a long, long time though to get human rights implemented international legislation. So we only got the Human Rights Act in 1998
in the UK.
Yep. In the UK, that's right. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights is, if you read it, it's actually a very inspiring document. The way it has been implemented, though, into domestic law is arguably less inspiring. I helped co-organise an Occupy Law event, which took place last week at Tent City University at St Paul's, where we had some eminent speakers talking about human rights. And Professor Conor Gearty, who is a human rights professor at the London School of Economics, talked about the fact that the Human Rights Act is actually a very inadequate instrument when laid onto a profoundly unjust society, in his words, and that the Human Rights Act is actually very inadequate because it prioritises private property rights over other types of rights, which one might think are much more valuable in society, like the right to protest and freedom of expression.
Okay, so we've seen that in action in the Occupy eviction case at St Paul's recently, where the judge ruled out appeals which were about the right to protest and upheld the kind of the rights of the corporation to, which was about protecting the right of way on the land. Was that what trumped the right to protest in that case?
Yeah, I mean there were various arguments that the corporation raised, but I mean essentially it came down to the private property rights of the corporation trumped right to protest.
Okay, but now the protesters, in theory, because we have the European Court of Human Rights, they could in theory take an appeal to the European Court and get get their rights defended at that level.
Potentially, yes. I know John Cooper QC who acted for the occupiers pro bono, is considering the options for taking the case to the European Court of Human Rights. But it's by no means, we don't really know what the European Court would say on it and whether they would side in favour of the occupiers.
Okay. It's all about implementation.
Yeah.
Where was I going to go with this? So it's a nice idea in theory, and it'd be great to extend those rights to the natural world as well, which is what wild law is all about. So it's not just humans that are protected in terms of rights. It's also recognising, as you say, the rights of other species, and obviously, in order to do that, you need to protect the habitats that they rely on for their survival, and so on and so forth. So, it's kind of about widening that that definition of rights and extending it, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the idea of extending, of legal recognition of rights of nature, I think we're going to come on to this a bit later, but the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, which has been proposed at, which was is being championed by Bolivia at UN level at the moment, that would be a natural companion to the Universal Declaration on human rights. And just because I said earlier that, there has been imperfect implementation of human rights, it doesn't mean that that idea is not incredibly valuable and has been really worthwhile and done a lot of good in society. I mean, I think that the concept of human rights has been extremely beneficial and has heralded a cultural shift in how we, how we view other people. And whilst law is by no means perfect, but you know, it can be a force for good if you know if it's implemented properly.
I mean, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, about one of the problems with the implementation of the human rights stuff is that corporations, somewhere along the line, they were conferred with the rights, the same rights as human beings, and so when a case is brought under human rights, these two things are in balance or offset one against one another, and often the corporations tend to win out.
Yeah.
Is that one of the problems? And if so, that's one of the things presumably that we should make sure isn't repeated when if this idea is extended to the rights of nature.
Yeah, you've identified a very difficult issue there. I mean, yes, there is a huge problem with the sorts of rights that you know we acknowledge corporations to have. For example, corporations have various human rights, quotation human rights, and that has led to all sorts of problems, really. Again, Professor Conor Gearty last week, he talked about the fact that corporations use their rights both as a sword and a shield against the state. So for example, to defeat legislation that would regulate them, and to defeat the interests of the communities in which they want to sort of go in and do things that the community doesn't want. So there is certainly a massive problem with corporate power and the kind of rights that corporations hold.
So one of the things that's coming up is we have one of these global spectacles, if you like, on the horizon. In June, we have the 20th anniversary summit of the original Earth Summit in Rio, which was 1992. So this one is the Rio plus 20 Earth Summit. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a big opportunity to do something to... We know we have all these environmental problems, and in fact we knew we had all these environmental problems 20 years ago, which is why we had this conference. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have done very little. What seemed to come out of that conference seems to have been very much voluntary agreements and kind of warm words and things that were very... friendly towards the corporations, in the corporations very much like a hands off in terms of regulatory framework, so that they can maximise their profits. So that's what we had 20 years ago, and in the intervening 20 years, of course, environmental problems have increased. But we do have this big opportunity in June, perhaps, to do something sensible. So could some of these legal proposals, like Earth Rights, help give us some kind of more sustainable framework for how we move on with this system that we're all living in?
Yeah, I hope so. I've already mentioned the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth. Can I talk a little bit about that?
Okay.
So this was a document that came out of the World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth. This was a big world conference hosted in Bolivia in Cochabamba in April 2010, following the failure of the Copenhagen talks in 2009. That conference was attended by 35,000 people, and as I said, this declaration came out of it. That the declaration recognises the rights of nature. It talks about Mother Earth being a living being, and how we're all sort of part of the earth, and sets out the inherent rights of the earth, including the right to exist and to flourish and to continue its vital processes free from human alteration, things like rights to a habitat, right to clean water and clean air, and the things that are necessary for the survival of life. So that was a very it was a very inspiring document, and it also it does have some it does have a scientific basis in the sense that it's very it fits in with the Gaia theory. So James Lovelock's theory, which sort of states that all life is interconnected, and you need to look at things holistically. And that's what the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth does. And this is, as I said earlier, this is being championed at the UN level by the Bolivian state. Latin American countries in particular seem really... they really get rights of nature. And I think this is influenced by the fact that they have sort of large indigenous populations that sort of... That don't really see, or they don't have the historical baggage that we have in Western countries, where we tend to see nature as, or at least our legal system treats nature as property. And human beings, we sort of have this philosophical tradition whereby human beings are sort of separate and superior to nature, and nature is sort of matter and not, doesn't have intrinsic value, whereas other cultures do have a connection with nature and recognise that it's that it has intrinsic worth in itself. So Bolivia is championing the declaration, but also Ecuador has its constitution that it passed in 2008 recognises the rights of nature. I believe it's Article 71, and there have been some cases. Brought in Ecuador, which you know I'll talk about later if you're interested in hearing. As I said, these proposals have been submitted to the Rio Plus 20 conference. I hope the UN hears them out because they're very, very significant, and globally there's a lot of support for them. Unfortunately, it's the corporations won't like it because it's not in their interest.
It's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, you say it's not in their interest, and I think I had a similar discussion with Polly Higgins about mm-hmm. about you know how the corporation's going to react if in her case her campaign is about getting ecocide. Enshrined as the fifth international crime against peace. So in that case, we're talking about large-scale damage to ecosystems that would be criminalised.
Yes.
Her attitude was that it would actually make corporations, it would give them a framework in which to operate. If that was an international... instituted internationally, then all companies would be on the kind of same level playing field, if you like. Yeah. What tends to be a problem is if you do things unilaterally on a national basis, then corporations will threaten. They'll say, we're just moving to Ireland or something. Mm. Mm. So doing it internationally seems to be have a real kind of benefit. And maybe there's not so much of an argument because, as I say, they're all on the same playing field.
Yeah, I think Polly's proposal is a no-brainer. I mean, ecocide is the environmental equivalent of genocide, so I don't see how anyone could be against ecocide. I see rights of nature as being more radical. Actually, I agree with you. I can see corporations totally being behind what Polly is saying. I mean, you're talking about things like, criminalising the directors at BP for the Deepwater Horizon tragedy, and things like stopping the Canadian tar sands. I mean. That level of destruction is clearly wrong.
Yep.
Clearly very wrong, yeah.
Yeah, perhaps we can just look a bit more at the kind of compare and contrast with those two initiatives or proposals. Because with ecocide, it's very easy to bring a case because you can say, oh, here is an example of large-scale damage to an ecosystem, and you can... evidence it and prioritise it as a significant case. with giving rights to nature, it's like, you know, where do you draw the line? It's like, can I walk out in the street and step on an ant, you know, inadvertently, you know? It's very difficult to not have any impacts on the natural world. Is there some case to be made about minimising harm, or perhaps as an idea of be useful to bring that kind of idea into it? I mean, otherwise, where do you draw the line with these things?
Yeah, it's,
I don't know. Or was it just symbolic? Does it have a use value as a kind of marker, if you like?
It's a good question. It's one that a lot of people have raised. I mean, I think clearly human beings have a need to use aspects of the natural world, you know, for basic subsistence, if nothing else. So, you know, clearly we need to have some kind of impact on our environment. I think it's most useful to think about rights of nature, and it is, just to be clear, it is recognising the rights of nature rather than giving rights to nature. For me, it's more helpful to think about it in terms of balance. So clearly, at the moment, we are having a highly destructive, or we have a very exploitative relationship with nature, and this is to our detriment as well. Because if we carry on as we are, then you know we're quickly going to use up all the world's you know, resources, quotation marks, and you know we're not going to be able to support ourselves, you know, humanity, let alone all the other species on this planet that are going extinct at, you know, a hugely alarming rate because of the impact of human beings.
Okay. I'm just wondering, it's probably a good time to have a break. We're about halfway through, so we can listen to the sounds of another species as a breather. And we'll come back to you in a few minutes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, that was the sound of emperor penguins from Antarctica, and you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. We're in the middle of the clear spot tonight, and have Melanie Strickland in the studio from Wild Law UK, who I think it's right, am I right in saying the group's main campaign really is to have an Earth-centric law rather than a human-centred law, which
yes.
we have currently,
yes.
and very specifically to champion a universal declaration for the rights of Mother Earth or something along those lines.
Yeah, and also to get the rights of nature recognised in domestic legislation too.
Okay. So you touched on Ecuador a little earlier on, where they modified their constitution to recognise the rights of nature. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. In 2008, Ecuador passed a new constitution, and I believe it's at Article 71. There's a provision that recognises the rights of nature. And there have already been a couple of cases, actually, under that constitution, which I'd be happy to talk about.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to know. Are they things that have happened in Ecuador that are being challenged, or I presume that's the only jurisdiction that they've, you know, can bring cases under, really?
Yeah. One case has been, you know, it was an incident that occurred actually in Ecuador, but the other case is for an incident that occurred, you know, that didn't occur within Ecuador. And the reason why they're able to take the case is because under the constitution, it recognises the principle of universal jurisdiction. So where there has been some damage to nature in any part of the world, really, under this principle of universal jurisdiction, they can take the case, or a claimant can take the case under the constitution of Ecuador. And in fact, that relates to the second case I'm going to speak about. It's a similar principle, actually, with genocide. So a genocide committed anywhere in the world can, in theory, I believe, be taken to the International Criminal Court and tried there. So the first case I wanted to talk about, the first successful case under the constitution of Ecuador, was a case that concerned the Vilcabamba River. And this went to a provincial court in Ecuador in March 2011. And the issue there was a company, I believe it was one of the states in Bolivia, so like local government there, was widening a road by the Vilcabamba River, and they were dumping construction material into the river, which was altering its flow and having an effect on, you know, the migration of fish and you know, marine life in the river. And I think it was some residents in the local area took the case to court, claiming that the rights of nature were being, as set out in the constitution, were being violated, and the river won. So the remedy for that was an injunction to stop the dumping of the excavation material into the river. So this was really quite significant. It showed that it is possible to, you know, this rights of nature legislation is actually workable in practice, and you know, in that case, it was the river that won, as opposed to what would, you know, typically be the case under a jurisdiction like the UK, for example. It wouldn't be, you know, a river doesn't have any rights in and of itself. It would always be in relation to the property rights of the person that owned the river, quotation marks. So that was, you know, that was quite significant. The other case is one that is not resolved yet, as far as I'm aware. And this is a case that was filed by Vandana Shiva and Nemo Bassi, who are various famous environmental activists and various other environmental activists, filed to the Constitutional Court of Ecuador in November 2010 against BP following the Deepwater Horizon disaster that BP would like us to think is fine and there are no sort of continuing problems there. So this is relevant to your question earlier about whether, you know, whether it can only be violations of the rights of nature actually in Ecuador. You know, obviously this happened in the Gulf of Mexico. So the case has been accepted. I did have a quick check on the internet today and I couldn't see that there'd been any further update. So, you know, unfortunately legal processes can take a really, really long time. Yeah,
so it'd be interesting to see how that develops.
It is really interesting to see how that develops. And what I also think is really interesting and noteworthy is the sort of remedies that the defenders of nature are asking for. So they're not asking for money because money can never, you know, money can't compensate for the, you know, for the destruction of nature and the violation of the rights of nature. What they're asking for is for full disclosure by BP of data relating to, you know, relating to that incident, because they don't believe that BP has disclosed all the information. Lots of people would agree with them. They're asking for a moratorium on deep water drilling because it's, you know, it's just not safe. And they're also amongst other things, actually asking for BP to leave an equivalent amount of oil in the ground as they allowed to spill. So I think it's interesting to see the kinds of remedies that they're asking for, because then they're very different to what is traditionally pleaded for in a court, and you can really see that these kinds of remedies sort of promote healing of the earth and you know, and give people access to environmental data, so make BP more transparent and more accountable. Normally in a legal system where something like this happens, you know, in a traditional legal system, if you like, BP would get fined a bit, but they're a massive company and they can afford the fine, so it doesn't really have any impact on their behaviour in the future. Whereas this rights of nature legislation sort of forces a cultural change within the company itself.
Yeah. As you say, the usual thing would be a fine, perhaps. I mean, I think it's an American case, case going through the American courts. Probably numerous cases going through the American courts, but certainly kind of Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act in relation to the BP Gulf oil spill. One of the cases was delayed a week, I think, this week.
Yes, that's right.
But the as you say, what will come out of that would be a massive fine for BP. Massive. It will sound massive, but maybe, you know, in the company's kind of long term.
Yeah.
Business plan, it will, you know, they'll be up and running again, and they'll just be doing what they've, you know, continuing to operate in the same manner.
Yeah.
So this is a very interesting approach.
Yes.
Okay, we were going to talk about a couple of these things in relation to Occupy, the Occupy movement, and whether in fact these two and any of these things link up at all. One link is perhaps these community rights ordinances. Perhaps you could say something about that, but also something about the group and the community that was responsible for drafting them up, because I think they sound very interesting and have done something very interesting on a local level with regards to defending their natural environment, the local natural environment, against corporations. Is that essentially what's going on?
Yeah, sure. Just before I come on to that, just wanted to mention that I think earth rights, the concept of earth rights, is very, very relevant to Occupy more broadly. I've written a number of blogs about this on the website www.wildlawuk.org. Quick plug there. I think where it's most directly relevant is Occupy is a movement for democracy and justice, and the Rights of Nature movement is about earth democracy and earth justice. People like Vandana Shiva and others have written quite extensively about this as well. It's about nature having a voice in our democracy. And don't forget the all the other species, you know, the trees, the animals, mountains, rocks, etc. Some of them aren't species, but all the things in everything in the natural world, we all co-evolve together. You know, we're literally trees, animals, etc. They are our kith and kin in a very hard scientific sense, not just a kind of quirky poetic or metaphorical sense. So, you know, I don't think there's much philosophical justification for anthropocentrism, and I do think there's a lot of justification for there's a quote that's attributed to Einstein, but it might not be Einstein, that talks about the need to widen our circle of compassion to include all living beings. You know, I'm very much, you know, I very strongly agree with that. So that's a little bit about how I see earth rights relating to Occupy. In terms of community rights ordinances, and you asked me to talk a bit about the Community Environmental Legal Defence Fund, which is the US non-profit law firm that is promoting, started drafting the community rights ordinances and sort of is rolling it out to communities across the states. I'm not too sure how long the Community Environmental Legal Defence Fund has been going, but it's been going for a while. The lawyers there are called Thomas Lindsay and Mari Margill. They have a little radio show. If you have a look at their website and Community Environmental Legal Defence Fund's website, you can pick up their podcasts, which are very, very good. The idea behind the Community Rights Ordinance is to give power back to the communities and take it away from the corporations, because they recognise that the corporations have too much power, and you know, as Conor Gearty said, they use it as a sword and a shield against the state and against communities. The idea with the ordinance is to rewrite the law, because at the moment it's probably more more apparent in the states than it is over here just how big corporations are, because corporations are even bigger in the states than they are over here, and you know it's pretty obvious that they wield an incredible amount of power that's totally undemocratic and totally out of proportion. Community rights ordinances sort of came about typically where a community was facing, you know, typically an environmental threat, like a big corporation wants to come in and frack, or wants to buy up a load of land and plant GM crops on it, or wants to dump sewage sludge and call it fertilizer. In the community. So the Community Environmental Legal Defence Fund drafted these community rights ordinances, and as I said, they recognise the inalienable rights of the community. And where Rights of Nature comes into this, there's always a provision in the ordinance which says that natural communities and ecosystems possess the inalienable right to exist and flourish. And this right can be exercised by members of the community. So in the same way that it might happen over here that a child, for example, has a guardian that can act on its behalf, or in the same way that you have a spokesman to act on behalf of a company or some other legal fiction. That's how it might work over there. You'd have an individual that would represent the interests of of the community or the ecosystem, the natural community or the ecosystem.
Okay, maybe I can interject because I'm just curious about getting, you know, my head around the idea.
Yeah.
The community are basically writing their own law.
Yeah, effectively.
And so
yeah.
How is that recognised, and how what are the normal legal making bodies think about it, and how does it actually work?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a different legal structure over in the States than it is over here, and I don't know a huge amount about the legal system in America, but in terms of how it works, it's the municipality or the town that will adopt the community rights ordinance. And I know that there is at least one city that's adopted an ordinance. That's Pittsburgh. The communities don't have the power, as I understand it, to under federal law, I think that's the right term, to adopt these ordinances. They're asserting their right.
Right.
So that's quite important to recognise. But as I understand it, so far, no corporation has challenged the community. I mean, it might happen one day, but so far the communities that have adopted these ordinances have been successful in doing that. And I'm actually really keen myself to start a campaign or start a project where we might actually get or try and encourage a local London authority to adopt one of these community rights ordinances. And even if it doesn't happen, it would be great to kind of highlight to local people in the process the democratic deficit, the fact they don't have all these rights that perhaps many people think they ought to have, and they might not realise just how much power corporations wield in their communities.
Okay. All right, well, we'll see. I mean, we'll watch this space, isn't
yeah.
it, for that one? Okay. We've only got about 5 minutes left, so we
that went quick.
I wonder what we can. There's a very busy show coming up next, so we need to give them a bit of a setup time. Mm-hmm. Let's see what else is on the list. I mean, going back perhaps to the beginning of where we came in was that. The Rio Plus 20 summit is coming up. I mean,
yeah.
I know in one sense it represents an opportunity to perhaps get some sensible legal measures on groundwork done, and on the other hand, it could be just governments and corporations doing the same empty hollow promises, really. And I think it's only 2 days, I think, and even heads of state aren't, many heads of state. David Cameron's not even bothering to go. They're not really being asked to sign up to very much at the moment. But potentially, there's a ecocide is being put forward for the agenda,
yes.
For example, and earth rights as well.
Yes.
And this another interesting idea that's floating around is this idea about planetary boundaries.
Yes.
Do you need able to say anything about that?
Yeah, I can say something very briefly.
In a minute or two.
Okay, in a minute or two. Well, I would like to use that minute to encourage people to come to an event that's being hosted at the School of Ideas on Sunday from 2 to 4pm at 27 Featherstone Street in Old Street, where we're going to have Peter Roderick, who's actually put forward the planetary boundaries idea, sort of speaking, and we'll have other people speaking on earth rights and guardians for future generations and some of the other interesting ideas that we've spoken about. Planetary boundaries is sort of based on a report that was published in Nature in 2009, which identified 9 planetary boundaries. It was things like climate change, water use, phosphates and nitrogen cycle, biodiversity loss. Peter's idea is that we need to kind of... The planetary boundaries have been identified and humanity needs to stay within the safe operating zone. And we can entrench this into law to make sure that we don't breach those limits.
Mm. Okay, we do have a little longer.
Okay.
So I understand this is all kind of this is fairly heavyweight scientific stuff that's gone through. I think the paper there was a paper published in Nature that quite a large body of scientists.
Yes.
Drew together what we know about planetary boundaries. Yes. and looked at, I think they identified maybe 9 or so far, but they're saying yes. There are others. More work needs to be done. But we have potentially overshot on 3 of them already, which is quite disturbing. Mm. And as far as I can understand, in the discourse around RioPlus20, a lot of people are saying, you know, this is, you know, the time is right for this. This is like, this is just... there is no more common sense proposal that you could think
Absolutely.
Of. Let's not as a global community, let's not transgress what we understand to be planetary limits in terms of our knowledge about how these, you know, Earth systems work and interact with one another. So I'm all for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of telling that, you know, in 1992 it was called the Earth Summit, and no one really speaks about this summit as the Earth Summit anymore. And I think that's in recognition of the fact that it really has nothing to do with the Earth. All the proposals that are being put on the table aren't really about promoting life flourishing on Earth. They're to do with what is described as sustainable development, which is actually has no connection with the Earth. Mm. At least the proposals that are on the table at the moment.
Okay, I'm wondering what the best way is for people to find out about this event.
There is a Facebook group, RioPlus20. There's a Facebook group. There's also, if you go to the www.wildlawuk.org, if you go to the events tab there, our event at the School of Ideas on RioPlus20, the legal approaches to RioPlus20 is up there, and people can find out more information there.
Okay, so this is the new bank of ideas, if you like, the new kind of occupied venue for self education and what have you. So
it's a very nice venue, very inclusive space.
Okay, all right. I think we're going to have to wind up. And give these next show a bit of grace. But thanks very much, Mel, for coming in today.
And thanks, Phil.